Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Saturday, November 18th, 2017, starting at 12:43 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 135th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Ryan Kurzak about the concept of Sati Sati in Indian astrology, which is Saturn's transit to the natal moon sign. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Really good. Thanks for doing this with me today. I'm excited to talk to you. The last time we talked, I did an interview on your YouTube channel in September where we talked about my book, and we focused on the topic of the similarities between ancient Hellenistic astrology and Indian astrology, of which I think we learned pretty quickly that there are many, right?
Exactly. Yes.
So one of the similarities that I've always been interested in, or one of the topics I talked about earlier this month, is we, with a couple of friends on an earlier episode, we talked about the Saturn return. And one of the concepts that I've really drawn from ancient astrology that's been really useful within a modern context is that Saturn transits are not just by degree when it gets close to the exact return, but sometimes when Saturn moves into a new sign or returns back to its natal sign, that in and of itself, as a concept from traditional astrology, the transit really becomes active at that point. And in terms of studying transits and in terms of ancient astrology, it seems like one of the things that both ancient Western and Indian astrology share in common is this notion that sign-based aspects are important and relevant, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So I think, and there's a really good example of that that comes up that's become kind of a popular concept in Indian astrology, which is this idea of the Saturn transit to the natal moon sign. So that's what I wanted to talk to you about today.
Sure.
And we'll get into that in a bit. So first, maybe just tell me a little bit about yourself, like where are you from and what's your background in astrology?
Well, I'm originally from West Virginia, where I was able to spend a lot of time meditating and spending hours immersed in astrology books because there wasn't a whole lot of anything else to do. I began studying astrology about a year after I got involved in Kriya Yoga practices and meditation practices. So that was at least 17 years ago. And since that time, I'd been studying Vedic astrology primarily because it was the astrology closely related to the practice of yoga and meditation. Mm-hmm. And I had a little bit of understanding of Western astrology when I was a teenager. I had a book on the sun signs, but never really got into it. And I actually have to be honest, for me, astrology wasn't something that I just fell in love with. It was something that my consciousness kind of forced upon me.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I've heard different stories, or how would you characterize that? I've heard different astrologers say like that they started as skeptics. I mean, would you go that far or?
Well, I would definitely go that far because I am a Virgo ascendant and I do have Saturn on the ascendant and Mars in my 10th house, and they're mutually aspecting each other. So I have difficulty believing things until I see things working out in practice.
Sure.
And when I studied philosophy and psychology in college, but then after I got involved in, again, this meditation process, someone said, you really need to kind of look at Vedic astrology. It can give you a lot of deep insights into people. And I said, yeah, okay, well, I mean, I can get good insights into people just by paying attention to them. And I decided to go ahead and get a Vedic astrological reading done. It was the first astrology reading I'd ever had. And the woman, she was very good at picking out psychological issues. She was very good at saying what certain difficulties I might have, how to remedy them. And she had never met me. She had no idea who I was. I barely had any idea who I was. And I found from that point forward that I couldn't quite ignore astrology. So that's when I started getting into it more so I could understand, number one, myself, understand others. And the more I saw it work out, the more enjoyable it became. I eventually started doing donation-based sessions for people. And eventually people said, look, you got to charge for this. So over the course of about 8 years of studying, of practicing, of doing donation-based sessions, that's when it eventually became a full-time practice for me where that was all that I did. So that's sort of how I got into astrology.
Okay, that's brilliant, because I was just talking in the last episode to Adam Ellenboss about how astrologers' students often find themselves in this like middle ground where they get stuck in, where they don't feel like they know enough about astrology yet, or they don't feel like they've mastered the subject, but you know, they have to, in order to really get that experience, you need to start seeing clients. And there's often a hard transition there to make between, you know, just learning it theoretically versus actually seeing people and learning from experience with clients and sessions and how to make that transition. So you did that through donation-based settings or sessions?
Yeah. And what you're talking about, it makes perfect sense. You know, I try to stress to my students that there is a huge difference between theory and practice.
Right.
A huge difference between the two. You know, you can read all these rules, you can study all these charts, but it's not until you actually start talking to someone and seeing just how those planets work out and the nuances and so on that you get a sense of how the language of astrology functions. And essentially that's what I did. I got interested in it. People said, hey, you're interested in it. Why don't you tell me about myself? And I would do a little bit. And then they started giving me money. And then it just sort of built into that. That's all I had time to do. So I had to turn it into a business so I could pay my bills.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and that sounds like a much more natural progression. I mean, the other idea that we talked about that I was interested that you mentioned, and that I know you do, is I had mentioned to Adam that I you know, another field where they seem to have a good model is like doctors have residency programs, but we don't usually have something like that in the astrological community, but you actually do something kind of close to that where you do an apprenticeship program, right?
Right. And that's exactly why I wanted to create this apprenticeship program. So it's a 4-year program that I do that takes people from the very beginning of these Vedic astrological principles, and it puts them together in, I look at it like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, it's one thing to learn about dignity, to learn about houses and so on, but you can't put it all together at once. You have to learn them separately and then put them together like a puzzle. So my goal was to do that. And then, of course, encourage people to look at other people's charts. And my apprenticeship program utilizes a lot of writing. So I have people look at charts, write articles, examine principles. And by doing that, then they start to see just how these things start to fit together. So in my mind, the students should eventually become better than the teacher. So I tell my students that all the time. I say, look, I'm doing my job when you know this better than I do. And luckily, I've found many students who are able to do that. So it's really one of the more enjoyable things I love doing with astrology.
Sure. I love that, because that was another thing we were talking about, was sometimes the dynamic between student and teacher and the need sometimes for the student to outgrow the teacher, and that sometimes creating tension either between the student or the teacher. But that's a great, if the teacher's going into it with the mindset that I want you to exceed me, that's probably going to lead to a much healthier dynamic when that eventually does take place, either because they have actually, you know, grown a better sense of mastery over the things, or just because they've gone in a different direction than you did. Either way, that probably right. leads to a much more amicable sort of split than it could otherwise.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know, it always comes down to, I had this discussion a lot with people of, you know, are you a famous astrologer or are you a good astrologer?
Sure.
And the issue is, you know, people can have charts that indicate fame, but maybe they don't necessarily have as much knowledge. And similarly, you can have people that have a lot of knowledge, but not as much fame. And so the way I've always looked at it is when I work with my students, yes, I check to see, are they going to be famous? Are they going to be more knowledgeable and so on? We try to work with them in that regard. But just like, you know, we're seeing how astrology grows, it keeps growing. You know, the things that you're discovering with Hellenistic astrology, rediscovering, I should say, with Vedic astrology, the way that people look at Vedic astrological charts now is radically different than the experiences I was having with teachers and students and seminars, you know, 15 years ago, because we're able to go deeper. And so the way I like to look at it is we're building upon this process. So I know a little bit, and I'm going to learn as much as I can about that little bit. And then I'm able to impart that to students, and then hopefully they'll embody that, and then they'll grow, and then they'll build upon that. I mean, that's the way I think all sciences should proceed. So that's the reason I come at it from that kind of angle.
Right. And that's the real meaning of tradition in the truest sense, or that's what tradition is about.
Right. Yes. It's not, let's just memorize all these dogmas and keep it this way for 2000 years. It's let's remember what we've learned, and now let's continue to improve and grow and evolve in this way.
Right. And having some sense of lineage in terms of the passing of the system from student to teacher, but also the growth of that and the development of the lineage.
Exactly. Yes.
All right. Brilliant. Well, that all sounds really good to me. And so one of the things you just mentioned about, you know, the distinction you were drawing between, you know, a famous astrologer versus a good astrologer is funny because you're talking about like placements for that. And that's one of the things I love about Indian astrology is there's a real clear sense sometime or clear interest in defining those different things. And I've been trying to, cause I, you know, you see a similar approach in Hellenistic astrology, and I've been trying to come up with a phrase for how to describe what you're doing there. And sometimes I call it like, it's kind of a modern phraseology, but like archetypal scenarios. But I don't know if that's like the right, it's not, you know, cause it's borrowing almost like a Jungian concept, which might be inappropriate in this context, but you know, I like that idea in traditional astrology that there's different scenarios and that Indian astrologers and Hellenistic astrologers often share in common, like an interest in thinking about like what are the different scenarios in each situation and that you could have different outcomes and what would you expect to see in the chart for one outcome versus another. Right. And Indian astrology seems to have a preoccupation with that sometimes in a very positive sense.
Well, right. I mean, if we think about it, you know, the ideas in Vedic astrology of yogas and yogacarikas were things that produce greatness within the chart. And there are four different kinds of yogas. You know, we have dharma yogas, which are yogas of inspiration. Are you following your purpose and your power? There's yogas for wealth. Are you able to manage your responsibilities? There's yogas for enjoyment. Are you able to enjoy your life? There's yogas for moksha or liberation and knowledge. Are you able to kind of transcend this experience and have a deep abiding sense of really what is important in life and how to be free within this human vessel? And as an example of that, you can have people that have what we call liberation or moksha yogas. But if they don't have any power or purpose yogas, then that liberation can simply be, you know, I sit on my couch smoking dope all day.
Sure.
But if you have a sense of power and purpose with it, that's when we tend to get people who are more interested in wisdom and knowledge and being liberated from the mind in a more healthier fashion. So in Vedic astrology, it's simply by taking the idea of the house lords and what are those house lords related to, and how do they combine in the chart? And are they combining in places that are of, that give activity, like the 10th house or the 7th house, you know, the angular houses and so on. So I would imagine that it would translate very well, you know, to Western or Hellenistic astrology, just using those kinds of principles.
Yeah, definitely. And that was, I talked in, I think it was in June, I did an interview with Ernst Wilhelm about the concept of planetary yogas and his book on the subject. And that was... Right. You know, that's such a great intro to Indian astrology just because it's something that's readily applicable that you can start taking and applying to your chart that doesn't necessarily, at least with some of the yogas, doesn't require you to learn a completely new system, but at least lets you sort of put your toe in the water to get a sense for what it's about and why it might be something interesting that could draw you into that approach.
Exactly. And bringing up Ernst, you know, it is important to remember that Ernst, a while back, had a chat with me back in, I don't know, 2010, I think. And I did eventually switch from using the sidereal zodiac to tropical zodiac. So for your listeners who are tropically based or Western astrology based, I see no issues using Vedic techniques with the tropical zodiac. It's just a new, or not a new, it is a line of thinking that can be applied to the tropical zodiac to give some of these, to kind of fill in these maybe holes that possibly could be in Western astrology. I say that cautiously because I have to be very clear that I have never really studied Western astrology. So I don't know if there are actually holes like this in Western astrology.
In terms of what?
In terms of being able to see things like yogas or kinds of combinations. I don't know if
they're... Oh, yeah, no, I will say that before you on your behalf as somebody who is familiar with the Western astrology, that there are holes in it and that this is certainly an area where I think I like the way that it's been developed to a much higher level in Indian astrology. So there's plenty of things that Western astrologers have to learn from Indian astrologers when it comes to that. So I'll go ahead and let you off the hook and clear you of that, and I'll say it myself.
Good. Well, I also like to be clear that I really think it goes both ways. I mean, personally, I think that there is one science or system of astrology, and I think that the Vedic techniques, that they have a portion of it, and maybe the Hellenistic astrology has a portion of it, and even Western astrology has a portion of it. And I think that kind of integrating those things along the lines, personally, I enjoy the tropical zodiac more, but using the tropical zodiac, that kind of gives the fuller picture of the vastness of the science of astrology.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because you are one of the, you know, you're actually the third now of the sort of Vedic astrologers I've interviewed who uses the tropical zodiac, right. Starting with Ernst and then Vic, Dakara, and then you. And you three are basically three out of what, maybe four or five definite, like, leading or relatively prominent astrologers that have adopted and have promoted that approach at this point, although it seems to be growing, because then I've seen a number of you have students that are then going on and carrying out that sort of lineage, so that it's become much more popular than it was maybe 10 years ago. I remember when Ernst first released that paper, and it was very controversial, right. But he was kind of like the only one taking that sort of stance at the time. But now it seems like there's a lot more of you at this point.
There's certainly a heck of a lot more of us. And, you know, even, you know, there are a few of us which are a little more well-known on YouTube and so on, but there are so many more students, so many more people getting involved in it. And I do have to be very clear that with Ernst, he was my initial introduction to the thought of it. My teacher, Richard Fish, before him, he passed a few years ago, but he was a Western astrologer and a Vedic astrologer. And so he was okay using both as well. But beyond that, and I'll let the subject fall here, there is actually a history of folks in India 30, 40, 50, 60 years back also getting involved in using the tropical zodiac. It just wasn't well known, nor was it really well accepted. So Ernst kind of, I think, brought it more into our awareness. But there is a history of even individuals in India using the tropical zodiac going back to Sri Yukteswar's time, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, and so on. So it's not brand new. It's just people are more aware of it now, I think.
Sure. And, you know, and that's important and useful, you know, just in historical context. It's important and useful, as we mentioned before, because sometimes, you know, for Western astrologers who are already using the tropical zodiac and that's what they're comfortable with, it can make Indian astrology a little bit more approachable to know that you yourself, you know, as I'm interviewing you, use the tropical zodiac, and that's how we're going to apply some of these techniques in this discussion. And so sometimes that can make an easier transition point into Indian astrology. You know, whatever they end up doing with it after that point, you know, is sort of on them, but yeah, just making that point that sometimes it can be useful as an intro, or a little bit easier than also completely switching zodiacs right from the start.
Right. Well, if you're using tropical, I would not advise you to switch zodiacs, but that's just me.
Right. Yeah. We had I did a whole series on like the zodiac thing this summer, and I did.
Right.
We had Vic, and Vic, you know, did his somewhat more polemical style. And then I had a Western astrologer who had switched to sidereal, and he also had a somewhat more polemical style. So we've done this whole thing at this point. So, we'll leave it at there that you'll be using the tropical zodiac, and that's what you prefer as we're going through this discussion.
Exactly. Yes. And the only thing I would add to that is the only issue that might possibly be something to consider is that doing Vedic astrology, I do still use whole house, whole sign houses. So, I will not be able to speak to I think they're called interceptions. Is that it? Where you have like a sign crossing over houses. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, well, luckily I use whole sign houses as well. And that's pretty much the standard on this podcast. So most of my listeners are already, that's another, you know, easy and interesting thing is that in reviving Hellenistic astrology, we found that whole sign houses was the main system of house division. And a lot of Western astrologers have started to adopt that over the past 10 years since it's been rediscovered. But then what's hilarious about that is Indian astrologers have been using that approach for 2000 years now. So it's something that you guys never lost, basically, but we did.
Great. I mean, it's good to know that we don't have to kind of get into that. It's just a given for your listeners. So that's good. But yes.
Sure. All right, so let's jump into our main topic then. And this is a topic that has gained some mainstream currency, it seems like. It's sort of one of those things. It's not up there with, you know, Western astrologers talk about like Mercury retrograde, or sort of the Saturn return itself has almost started to seep into popular consciousness as well sometimes as a thing that people go through in their late 20s.
Right.
This concept of sati sati is almost the Indian equivalent of that to some extent, right? Or would you say it's up there in terms of popular consciousness?
It's definitely up there. And you know, how I judge these things is I go look at my YouTube channel and see what are the most popular videos. And the most popular videos are almost always videos dealing with Saturn, the sati sati, the Saturn return. And then next in line would be Rahu and Ketu in the nodes of the moon. And it makes sense because there is such folklore and myth, and there is such a sense of dread around transits of Saturn that people are scared. And when you're scared, you tend to kind of want to figure out what's going on there. So I would say it's definitely one of the more popular topics in Vedic astrology.
Okay. So let's go ahead then and define it and talk about what it is and how maybe it's defined in different approaches versus, you know, what definition we're going to be using here.
Right. Okay. So sati sati, essentially what this means, it's a 7.5 year period of Saturn's transit. And it's specific to the 7.5 year period when Saturn transits the sign before your moon, the sign of your moon, and the sign after your moon. And so generally it takes Saturn about 2.5 years to go through a sign. So that's why the sati sati is related to the 7.5 years it takes to go through those three signs.
Okay, so the sign before the natal moon, the sign of the natal moon, and then transiting the sign after the natal moon.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the typical definition of what people are looking for when they're saying, oh, look, I'm in my sati sati, or I'm starting my sati sati, or I'm ending my sati sati.
Okay, so the start would theoretically, if you're using that definition, be like when it first goes into the sign before, or when it transits through the sign before the natal moon, the middle point, or the most important point would be the sign when it's going through the sign of the natal moon.
Yes.
And then the ending would be when it's going through the sign after the natal moon.
Exactly. So if you've got the moon in Aries, then as soon as Saturn enters Pisces, typically people would say you're in your sati sati. And then once Saturn goes through Pisces, Aries, and then goes completely through Taurus, once it gets out of Taurus, then we would say you would be out of your sati sati. The sati sati would be over.
Okay, got it. And so that then it becomes this long period, and it's about that Saturn transit. The focal point is just Saturn's transit to the natal moon. And one of the part of the context behind that, though, of why that's important and why it's given such emphasis in Indian astrology is actually the moon itself is actually a really major player in Indian astrology and is almost given more emphasis in Indian astrology than it's given in Western astrology to some extent, where especially modern Western astrology has become very sun sign focused, but right. Almost in the same way that Western astrology is sun sign focused, Indian astrology has more of a lunar focus in some sense. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah. And the issue with the moon is that since the moon represents our jiva or our soul, and by that I don't mean this new agey thing that is your enlightened self. When I say soul, what I'm talking about is your collections of habits and tendencies, essentially what makes you think you are who you are. That's what the moon represents. And the moon changes signs, what, every 2.25 days. And so it was a way of looking at charts without having to have the exact birth time, because the ascendant, it can change as much as every, you know, 2 hours or so. So if we're looking at something that changes every 2.25 days, it makes it a little bit easier to look at a chart without having to be so specific about it. So really, I look at it like the sun sign is important. The moon sign is more important because it changes every 2.25 days versus every 30 days. And the ascendant is the most important because it can change up to every 2 hours. So it's just a level of definition, I suppose.
Sure. But to that extent, the moon, even when you have the birth time, sometimes Indian astrologers will look at the moon sign and then construct a set of derivative houses from the sign of the moon, like whole sign houses from that sign, and then read the chart from that perspective, right? What's that chart called?
It's called the Chandra Lagna. So Chandra means moon, Lagna means ascendant. And the reason they do that is because So the ascendant, we look to the ascendant to see what is the person's life path, such as what are you going to get involved in? What are you going to be doing? Who's going to come into your life? That's what the ascendant tells us. Whereas the moon sign, since it represents our sense of self, it in a sense can show us how we're going to react to the world. And if you know how someone's going to react to the world, oftentimes you can very easily predict their future.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's why we use the moon sign. And it's very important because you can see a person who has a very difficult life, maybe outlined by positions from the ascendant. But if you look at the moon sign and you see there's gentle planets like Jupiter or Venus helping out the moon, then that can show a person who might have a difficult life, but because of their grace and their poise and their ability to navigate those things, they're still appear to be, project themselves, and essentially are a good, wholesome, gentle person. So there's a lot of different kind of variables that you can pull into this to see how a person's going to act and why based on looking at the ascendant or the moon sign.
Okay, got it. And then more broadly, the moon is also important in Indian astrology because of the nakshatras or the 27 sign lunar zodiac, right?
That's correct, yes. And I'm not one of those individuals that uses the nakshatras a whole lot in looking at a person's chart and what that chart's going to say. Personally, when I think of Vedic astrology as it was originally practiced, I think it was definitely nakshatra-based, and I think it was more based upon electional astrology, such as saying, when is it a good time to do this ritual? When is it a good time to do this marriage? When is it a good time to undertake this task? Because I think you would probably agree, I don't necessarily consider horoscopic astrology taking shape in India until, what was it, 2,500 years ago or so. So the nakshatras I use more for the electional-based things, and the horoscopic astrology I focus more on our general understanding of the ascendant and so on.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, that at least gives some context for why the moon probably has this greater significance in Indian astrology, because you had this longer indigenous tradition of astrology that went back, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years before the arrival of horoscopic astrology and the use of the ascendant and houses and things like that,
right?
Where they had this more lunar based astrology that was focused on the nakshatras and those 27, what are they? They're like 13 degree signs basically that divide up the ecliptic into,
right,
different segments, and that was more like the indigenous sort of quote-unquote zodiac of India prior to that time.
Exactly, and when you read texts like Brihat Parashara Horashastra, Indian text, it essentially defines the zodiac as the nakshatra. So it says the zodiac are the nakshatras. So when we're thinking about Vedic astrology, if we're going to be real technical here, we would probably simply focus on the nakshatras for that reason.
Right, that makes sense. And then even some of the timing techniques, like the Vimshodari Dasha system, I think that's initially calculated based on the nakshatra that the moon is located in, right?
Exactly. The placement of the moon in the chart determines how the karmas, as represented by the planets, how they're going to function and how and when they're going to give their effects, which is the nature of the Vimshodari Dasha system, which you just mentioned.
Okay, great. So, you know, this is, you know, super important because we're starting to understand the context and the role that the moon plays as a pretty important significator in Indian astrology. Not to say that the sun or other planets aren't important, but there's just a number of these very unique things that Indian astrologers use, or like basic techniques or things that, you know, you might take for granted, but that looking at it from a Western standpoint where, you know, we don't have those things. And so there's almost less emphasis on the moon as a result of that.
Right. Yes, it makes sense.
Are there any other basic sort of meanings of the moon that you associate it with in Indian astrology that are really important in order to understand using that as the starting point, or just what the moon signifies, that we should maybe outline first before we get to talking about what it means when it's sort of transited by Saturn?
Right. Well, there's a few things. Number one, the moon represents our capacity to grow things within our chart. The moon is the capacity to grow and to nourish. That's why it's represented by the mother, and that's why it's represented of the ocean and so on. And this is also why the moon is essentially considered to be the lord of the nakshatras, and as it relates to that dasha system, because the dashas, or how your life's going to turn out, when things are going to happen and how they're going to happen, essentially that's based on how are they going to grow into your life. So the moon determines how are the karmas going to grow into our life. And it also shows us how we approach our life situation. Do we have a lot of cruel planets like Saturn and Mars impacting our moon, where we have to deal with a lot of adversity, and therefore we have to be a bit tougher, a bit stronger, a little coarser? Or do we have the moon influenced by Jupiter or Venus or Mercury, such that our life is more geared towards grace and ease and enjoyment? We don't have to deal with a lot of these difficulties. So when we're looking at the moon, it's giving us a deep sense of how are the karmas in our life going to grow? How and when are they going to show up in our life? When are they going to poke through the garden and give their fruits? And then also, how do we attend to our life? How do we approach our life? So when Saturn starts to impact that moon, it brings a lot of focus on the way we've been maybe mismanaging our life, or the way we've not been helping things to grow appropriately, which is why it can cause a lot of problems for people, depending on how they've treated their moon, how they've treated Saturn, and so on.
Okay, sure. And you mentioned karmas a few times, and it might be worth expanding on that. So within this context, we're talking about the results of past actions, essentially, right?
Yes. And so the idea of karma, it's extremely simple. Anytime you look at something within a person's birth chart, whether it's, we're talking about Western astrology, I imagine, or Vedic astrology, anything that's an indication, we consider that a karma. So if we look at someone's chart and we see that the indication is that you're going to have three husbands, well, that's a karma. If we see that you're going to tend to be depressed, well, that's a karma. If we see that you're going to be very good, your Mercury is in the 10th house, exalted, means you're going to be very good at managing things. You're going to be a really good manager. Well, that's a karma. So karma is essentially boiled down to what are the tendencies that you have, and they are based on past action, true, but we always have to remember that everything we do in every moment is creating karma for the future. So I state that only because many people who practice Vedic astrology are extremely fatalistic, and I am not one of those astrologers, because if you think about it, you had to do something in the past to get your chart where it is anyway. So if you can make peace with that and start doing things now that change that momentum, change that direction, or at least alter it, well, then the way the chart's going to express or grow will be radically different if you take different actions now. Does this make sense, what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, on the one hand, you have this idea underlying, it sounds like you can boil it down to like every action has a reaction, and that's basically the idea underlying karma in that context. But then also you're trying to be careful not to also to apply complete like volition or choice or blame in some sense, which is one of the issues that comes up with the concept of karma, I think. Is that partially where you're going with that?
Yeah, completely. And one way I always like to break it down, it's like this. It's if you eat hamburgers every day and smoke cigarettes every day, and you go to the doctor when you're 29, he says, you know, based on your past actions, you're probably going to have a heart attack in 5 years. Well, that's like going to the astrologer and they see Saturn, Mars, and Cancer in your fourth house. And they're going to say, you know, if you keep acting in this way, sure, you're going to have some cardiovascular issues. But if you become aware of that and you start exercising and you start eating more fruits and vegetables, well, then that's going to start to create a whole different energy or theme or pattern. So when I'm looking at an astrological chart, I'm not looking at it statically. I always have to take into consideration who is the person I'm talking to and how are they actually working with what's in their chart.
Sure. And I'm not sure if this is relevant here, but I've also heard that there's different types of karmas and that some might be harder to escape and others might be a little bit more negotiable in some sense. Is that something you follow as well?
Completely. And so that does bring in, I say I'm not fatalistic, and I am certainly not fatalistic, but it's just like this. When you look at a person's chart, and you see 10 indications that they're going to be run over by an 18-wheeler truck, that's a pretty strong karma. If you see two indications of it, you know that, well, maybe they should look both ways before they cross the street. So one of the things I like to do with people is when I look at their charts is determine what are the strongest karmas, what are the weakest karmas, and if someone's asking me about changing a situation or doing something different or achieving something, what I'll always do is look at, well, how strong is that karma? And so if they want to run a business and they have only one karma saying, yes, you will be successful at running a business, I will say to them, it's going to be very hard for you to do that. Not that you can't, but it means you're going to have to put a lot of time and attention to figuring out how to run that business. You see, so it's really based upon how often does it show up in the chart. The more it shows up in the chart, that's just like a stronger habit that you have, which means it's going to be harder to break and so on.
Okay, right. Yeah, I think both in modern Western and I think in ancient Hellenistic astrology, they had sort of like a rule of three where sometimes if you see something once, it's like a maybe. If you see it twice, it's pretty likely. And if you see it come up in three different places, then it's almost definite in some sense.
Exactly. And that's exactly how I treat it. And the more I see it, the more I tend to think it's going to be harder to change. Or if it's a good karma, they might not need to do anything to make it happen. You know, when you get people who just magically get fame or who magically just fall into the right relationship over and over again, those are people who just in their chart show multiple themes of getting in good relationships. So it's all about these themes and these habits and, you know, what are you made up of from your astrological chart, essentially.
Right. And that's funny because it brings up an interesting point, and this might be a little bit of a digression, but there's an issue sometimes where I notice it comes up in like the astrological community and then the modern sort of new age community where there's, you know, the emphasis on free will and progress and everything else. But it's kind of tricky because sometimes it's like there's the people that almost have really good charts set up where you can almost see it in their chart where they're going to have the ability to actualize their potential and things go in their favor most of the time, and they don't have the same sort of obstacles or setbacks or just like sort of like bad luck or bad circumstances that other people have. And sometimes they have a tendency then to create a philosophy around that where they say that, like, you know, you can change anything in your life and everything's negotiable and it's all just a matter of, you know, your mindset. And like the most extreme version of that in modern Western society has been like the secret, you know, the new age thing of the secret and the concept that you just create your own reality based on your mental state and your sort of what you choose in your life.
Exactly.
It sounds that, you know, some of this discussion is almost getting in that territory when you were mentioning some of those things. And so that's interesting to me, the idea that, you know, in some instances that might be in a person's chart, whether they're able to do that or not.
That's exactly right. I mean, one of the things I do when I look at a person's chart is before I even look at their chart, I try to see, if I give them information, are they going to be able to use that information or are they going to be so fixated on the problems that they can't? So for example, people who find the secret working or this type of mind over matter type of things, they're typically going to have either a wonderful Jupiter or a lovely fifth or ninth house. And these are just very basic ways of looking at it. But when you have a nice Jupiter, a nice fifth house, a nice ninth house, things tend to work out very well for you. Even mm-hmm. when things go wrong, they will tend to work out well. But if you get someone who has a lot of difficulty in the fifth house, like a real difficult one is often Saturn in K2 in the fifth house, or Saturn in the south node of the moon in the fifth house, that tends to make a person hyper-focused on the problems. And the fifth house is our ability to use our intelligence to improve our life situation, to creatively deal with our life situation. And if you have Saturn in K2 there saying, yes, but you failed all these other times. Yes, but your dad never did this. Yes, but society tells you you can't do this. That makes it very difficult for the person to take the steps to actually make the change happen. So you're right on there that you can actually see in a chart, you know, will someone benefit by reading the secret? Will someone benefit by positive affirmation? Or will they benefit by having to be of service, a Saturn-related thing? Or will they be of benefit by having to train themselves to improve in a certain area, such as a Mars would do for them? So that's one of the beautiful things I find about this whole system, Vedic astrology at least, is that once you figure that out, you know who you're talking to, and you can kind of help them negotiate that if they're willing to do what needs to be done to improve their life situation, which will be different for everybody.
Sure, that makes sense. And although, in that instance, it's almost a distinction between those who are going to be inclined towards having a more optimistic and sort of creating their own reality attitude versus the one you were talking about was almost people that might have mental hangups that will hold them back from doing that. But would you say there's people who maybe through difficult placements are not in a position to create their reality as much in the sense that, you know, sometimes people just have, you know, bad luck or difficult circumstances and it's harder for them to escape from that in some concrete sense than, you know, maybe somebody else who just happens to be lucky and be in the right place at the right time.
Right. Well, that does take us into a little bit different area in the sense that I do like to be very clear that even people who have wonderful charts still have bad things happen to them.
Right.
And people who have horrible charts have wonderful things happen to them.
Sure.
The difference is typically that the individuals who have, again, more supportive, maybe optimism and so on. I'm not talking about a Pollyanna attitude of, you know, I hope it works out. I mean, they really just know how to make things work well. That when they have indications for that in their chart, when things go wrong, they tend to surf it better. They tend to navigate it better. They tend to create less problems for themselves. In the same sense, if you have people with more fixation on difficult things, they will tend to make a bigger mess of things when things do go wrong, and they'll tend to not really tap into the opportunities when things are going well. So in the very beginning, it's very important, hopefully, for people to see that, well, what is my general makeup? What is my general setting? And then learn to work with that. The problem is that most people don't have a lot of self-awareness to see that, because when they see things going really wrong, that's their whole life and that's all they're used to. So they can't imagine it going any way different. Whereas if people who have things going right all the time, when something goes wrong, they typically say, oh, well, I'll get over that. Things will get back to normal. So it's a very tricky way to look at the chart. But if you can work with someone long-term to help them see their patterns, eventually, even the most difficult chart can finally start tapping into the positive, more optimistic things. It just takes time and it takes attention to detail. That's the key to it, which is what Saturn is all about.
Sure. That makes sense. I was just thinking there's been an issue in sort of modern sort of New Age astrology in the past few decades where part of the answer to that difficult question about, you know, people that experience difficulty or hardship, sometimes it's boiled down and the desire to want to be empowering and saying that, you know, people can change any part of their life no matter what, and nothing is completely predetermined. Sometimes it backfires, or sometimes it mutates into this weird sort of implicit statement that if there are things going wrong in a person's life, or if you experience hardship or difficulty, that it's like your fault, or that because you have the power to control or change anything in your life, that if there's something going wrong, there's almost an implicit statement that that's your fault for not doing better or not changing it. And one of the things that's almost been refreshing to me about traditional astrology is sometimes it almost seems to free people from that by just saying that sometimes people have difficulty in some area of their life, and that's not necessarily the result of choices or personal volition. Certainly there are instances in which that is the case, in which it is the person reinforcing bad behavior or making bad choices or whatever else, but that sometimes there can be external circumstances that maybe happen to the person through no fault of their own. I'm not sure how that works in terms of, you know, other broader doctrines of like karma and things like that, but it's a reoccurring topic on the podcast.
Well, considering that Saturn is going to be our topic here, I mean, what does Saturn do? From the Vedic perspective, Saturn teaches us to endure those things which we cannot control. So right. we have two kinds of planets that deal with problems in Vedic astrology. There's Mars and there's Saturn. Mars is the planet that says, there's an emergency, something's on fire, get the hell out of the house. So Mars deals with immediate, difficult situations, and usually you have to respond by instinct, or you have to use your logic to get out of it. With Saturn, that's when, you know, Mars has done his best and you're still stuck with the problem. And so Saturn's issue is, okay, this is life. We have to experience this. We have to endure this. And so that's how Saturn helps a person. But the other thing about Saturn is that Saturn deals with the idea of reality. And this comes up over and over, because I don't just teach astrology. And actually, before I got into astrology and teaching astrology, my main focus was on meditation and Kriya Yoga practice. And one of the difficulties in that whole area, that whole field, is that if you just meditate right, if you just find the right guru, if you just pray right, then you're going to escape, you know, all the difficulties of life. And that's total BS. And I tend to lean a little more towards a Buddhist philosophy, in that stuff happens in life and it's very difficult. And it's those things and how we respond to them which helps us mature so that then we can maybe deal with future difficulties better. And even when difficulties do occur, you can say things like, you know, well, it's your fault, you weren't doing something right. But sometimes difficulties come into your life because a person does need to mature. I mean, think about an individual who maybe goes through an extreme health crisis, or their spouse goes through an extreme health crisis. And through that, they learn compassion, they learn patience, they learn to be more loving, more nurturing, and it inspires them to be that kind and compassionate and nurturing to other people who are also going through that difficulty. So just to kind of sort of tie it around to what we were starting with here, sometimes when bad things occur, difficult things occur, we don't really know whether it's going to lead to something greater, or if it's going to lead to a depth of maturity, or if it's going to help us have greater sense of compassion and understanding for those around us. And that's one of the gifts of Saturn, is that when you go through some difficulties of Saturn, you come out the other end and you do have all these more positive qualities, because you become more mature, more understanding, and so on.
Right, sure. And that's a great transition point back to our topic. So that's really, it seems like in a lot of the discussions, especially like the higher discussions, that the Satisati transit of Saturn over the natal moon sign and the sign before and the sign after, that's usually generally considered to be a very difficult transit or a very difficult time in a person's life in which some really challenging things can happen, but that occasionally the interpretation, it seems like sometimes, is that it can be a humbling experience where something positive can come out of it through the process of going through difficulties. Is that one of the interpretations?
Yeah, that's the best interpretation. I mean, that's the way I look at it. And again, we always have to remember that we're talking about humans and human nature, and we all respond differently to how these things occur. But for example, there's a book called The Greatness of Saturn, which is a book related to the mythology of the Satisati period. And in this book, The Greatness of Saturn, it's about a king who Saturn comes to him and says, I'm about to cross over your moon, so watch out. And he says, okay, I'll do some remedies for Saturn and so on. But then when it happens, this king essentially gets kicked out of his kingdom. He gets accused of theft. He gets his hands and his feet chopped off. He's put to work on an oil mill for 7.5 years. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going. And then at the end of the whole story, though, Saturn comes to the king and he says, you know, you've endured great suffering, you've developed patience. And the king sort of rolls over to him because he doesn't have hands and feet. And he says, I just pray that you do not treat anyone else like this. I pray, because Saturn asks if he would like a blessing. And he says, the only blessing I ask is that you subject no one else to this kind of misery. And Saturn then says, you know, bravo, King Vikramaditya. You could have asked for any boon. You could have had your hands and feet returned to you. You could have had your beauty returned to you. You could have had your kingdom returned to you. But you asked that no one else suffer as you have suffered. And because of that expression of compassion, Saturn then says, here you go. And he gives him his kingdom back. He gives him his hands and feet back. He gives him a beautiful bride. I mean, everything kind of comes back together after that. So the issue that we see here is that all the suffering, all the difficulty this king had to go through was certainly a humbling experience. It taught him quite a lot about himself, and that by becoming conscious and aware of the fact that, yeah, the world's shitty sometimes, quite to an extreme, and that we really need to think about others, that's where the gift and the blessing of Saturn, you know, comes into play due to this Satisati period.
Right. That's brilliant. And that underlying idea of developing compassion through suffering, essentially.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, that's a great book. So it's called The Greatness of Saturn. And who wrote it again? I remember reading it like 10 years ago, and it was really amazing. You know, you actually did a good job of summarizing it just now, but I'd recommend people check it out because it's a very intense read, but it's a great, not terribly long, it's a relatively short book, but it's a great sort of myth in order to give you some insight into this concept of this Saturn transit.
Yes. And Robert Svoboda, he's the author.
Okay, and he was the author of a great book on Indian astrology, Light on Life.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, cool. So this idea of developing compassion through suffering, and I guess, you know, a lot of the generic interpretations of it, and, you know, that people get freaked out about is the suffering part, basically, is right. The process that, you know, that this is going to be a transit where there's going to be some area of your life where you might experience loss or suffering or hardship. And that's the part that people often end up focusing on in terms of the concrete things that astrologers sometimes associate with the transit.
Right. And what a lot of people do when they start, when they get into this is they'll say that during your first Sedi Sati, you'll probably lose your grandparents. During the second Sedi Sati, you'll probably lose your parents. And during the third Sedi Sati, you lose your own life. And so there's a strong focus on loss, certainly. But one of the things I do have to be very clear on is that, just with all things, there is a lot of myth and folklore around this. And it really depends on how your chart is set up in regards to how the Sedi Sati is going to influence you. Because it may be that you've got it set up such that when you go through a Sedi Sati period, that the suffering you're going to have to endure is that you're going to have to be working really hard to support your business for 2.5 years. Or you're going to have to be working really hard to improve your relationships. And the theme that always comes down to working hard to understand and improve the situation. And so if people don't want to work really hard, or if they don't want to put the time and attention to improve a certain area of their life, that's when you're going to find a lot more suffering during the Sedi Sati period, which in turn relates back to the fact that the better Saturn is situated in your chart, the better you will typically work with the Sedi Sati period, because you already know how to work with Saturn. You already know what he's going to expect of you. You already know it's going to be hard and not to expect, you know, great rewards and gains during this time period. And so you work with it better.
Right. If you're already somebody who's comfortable with or in the mindset of the things that are sort of proper to Saturn, which is like putting in hard work or putting in your dues or subverting some of your personal preferences for what needs to be done at the time, then if you go through a period in which that's more of the focus, then you're already going to be a little bit adapted to it and deal with it a little bit easier than somebody who's not prepared to do any of those things.
Exactly. And that's why always, 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 when we consider this idea of Sedi Sati, the very first thing we have to do is see, what is the nature of this person's chart, the foundation of the horoscope? What is the nature of Saturn? To see how they're going to work with it. And then on top of that, you know, you mentioned the Vimshottari Dasha system a little earlier. And what I've seen is that if you are not in a Saturn period, meaning a Saturn cycle, Saturn Dasha, or if you're not in a Moon Saturn or Moon Dasha, the Sedi Sati period, sometimes you don't even notice it. It's you have to be in a period that is kind of pushing that agenda for Saturn to give that effect in the first place. So this is, again, why I love talking about this, because the folklore is this. Oh, look, Saturn's crossing over your moon. Okay, be prepared for all this terrible thing to occur. By the way, go buy a $4,000 blue sapphire from my friend down the street and everything will be okay.
Right. You know?
So it's interesting.
Yeah, there's two different sort of threads there I definitely want to follow. So one of them is something that Indian astrology and Hellenistic astrology share in common, which is the idea that transits are not the first line of prediction necessarily, but first that you have to calculate the Time Lord and the Dasha periods, and that's going to tell you which planets are going to be activated in your chart at different times in your life. And then you look to the transits at that point, because a transit is not going to be very major or is not going to necessarily even produce an effect unless it's activated as a Dasha or as a Time Lord, right?
Exactly. That's exactly correct. Yes.
Okay. So that's a crucial, you know, thing right from the start, that not everybody is going to experience this as major, but if you have Saturn or the moon activated through the dashas at that time, then that's going to put more of the focus on those planets, and therefore it might be more of a focal point in your life at that point.
Exactly.
And then separately, you were bringing up the, you know, sort of an issue about remedial measures, because that's something that's very prominent in Indian astrology. It's not as prominent. There's some traditions of remedial measures in Western astrology, and it's actually only recently with the revival of traditional astrology that we're starting to see. Especially some medieval and Renaissance astrologers are starting to revive the practice of remedial measures. And that's something that in Indian astrology, there's a strong tradition of, but there's also some sort of problematic issues surrounding that as well, I think, right?
Completely. Yeah. The issue that usually comes up is that there is, again, this idea that, number one, things are fatalistic. Number two, if you just do these very basic things, and yes, they may be extremely expensive, so it can cause you to have to put a lot of time and attention towards being able to do it, then things just work out. And again, just like we discussed seeing whether a person will be able to benefit from, say, positive affirmation or so on, it is possible to see what kinds of remedies a person will benefit from. So for example, if Mars is doing very well in a person's chart, then this would be someone that I might say, yes, we need to do some gemstone therapy for you. If we saw the moon in very good dignity and very well placed, we may say you would benefit by herbal treatments, dealing with plants if it's a health issue. Or the moon also does deal with things like positive affirmation and visualization. If it's Saturn, well, then we'd look at things like being of service to the less fortunate, or doing regular fasts and things of this nature. So the issue is that most people have just kind of glommed on to these very, these very generic kind of remedies, and they have not actually taken the time to learn, well, for this person's chart, what are the remedies that are actually going to work for them? And I made this mistake too. When I love gemstones personally, whether or not it works for me, I enjoy jewelry. People would write to me and they'd say, well, what about this gemstone? And since I love them so much, I'd say, sure, get this yellow sapphire, get this pearl. But it wasn't until I actually learned, wait a minute, it doesn't work the same for everybody. Right. That remedies became more effective in my own practice when I advise them to people.
Okay. So, and one of the interesting things, because this is kind of tied in with sort of Indian medicine or the indigenous, like Indian medicine traditions of Ayurveda. And one of the things that's interesting about that is the idea of balancing and counterbalancing is part of the thing that's sort of built into that medical tradition, which then seems to blend over into the astrology as well in terms of what your actual approach is in the chart in terms of counterbalancing different things or not necessarily overemphasizing something, because then you might create an imbalance of some sort.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, again, when you're looking at the chart, that gives you those insights into, you know, what is too strong in the person's awareness? What is deficient? What is weaker in the person's awareness? And once you get a sense of that, then you're more easily able to relate to them in a way that will be more specifically helpful to their current state and situation.
Sure, sure. And do you feel, I mean, when it comes to, I'm trying to remember if we ever talked about this. I mean, do you feel, because it seems like sometimes remedial measures, that's also an area where there's some abuse or there's a potential for sort of exploitation of people overemphasizing that, or people that don't really even have much astrological background recommending, you know, remedial measures or very expensive ones. I mean, what are your feelings when it comes to that sort of topic?
Well, I think it's a bad idea, but but yeah, there are we have to remember that just because someone says they're an astrologer or is interested in astrology, it doesn't necessarily mean they have your highest and best interest in heart. So that's why, you know, you can talk to one astrologer and they'll say, oh yes, go buy this Rudraksha bead, which is a type of seed that helps you astrologically. And some of those can cost like $1,400. And then you find out, oh, well, turns out that person who wants you to buy that just happens to have a little kickback thing with the person who's selling it. So it's just like anything else. You just got to be careful of who you're interacting with. So it's human nature, I think, to have that issue.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't overemphasize that. It's just an interesting side sort of thing that comes up, or I'm sort of generally aware of.
Well, I wish it wasn't that way. And the trouble is that since, you know, astrology is seen as a holy science, most people just sort of think, well, it's a holy science, so therefore everyone who's interested in it should just be holy, nice people.
Right.
Well, it's not always the case.
It's an interesting sort of side effect of greater acceptance of astrology in a culture. Because one of the things that's funny about, you know, in the West, and especially in like New Age astrological circles, there's this presumption that like someday astrology will be widely accepted again in the West, and it'll make society better and everything will be great. But, you know, in India, where astrology is more culturally accepted, You know, sometimes there can be, you know, not good side effects of that, or there can be instances where people try to exploit that acceptance in a way that's not necessarily appropriate. So it's just interesting from a Western perspective that, you know, because there's these over-idealistic assumptions that astrology being accepted is always going to be inherently positive and can't have any downsides, you know, in some instances, perhaps there might be.
Well, I had one person who was a client of mine, and he wasn't able to get into the session with me for a while. And finally he did. And he said, my astrologer recommended that I get a yellow sapphire for my Jupiter. And he said, yeah, it happens to be a $20,000 yellow sapphire. Wow. And I nearly choked. I said, look, buddy, I said, if you can afford a $20,000 yellow sapphire, I don't think you've got any problems with Jupiter.
Right.
You know? So, you know, it's this kind of thing that's promoted, but it's the same thing with religion. So when we think about astrology and religion, they're going to go hand in hand, and we just have to be very cautious and conscientious and maybe experiment a little bit on our own to see what works and what doesn't work. That's really the best bet. If you don't have access to someone that you trust, that's the issue.
Sure. Yeah. And then you also run into an issue there between like what is, when it comes to astrologers and astrologers having, you know, sometimes different opinions about specific placements or how they would interpret specific placements in a birth chart, where do you draw the line between, you know, I would interpret that and recommend like a different remedial measure, or say that that placement is not as afflicted as this other astrologer is saying, versus, you know, when is it the other astrologer that's saying something that's just completely out of left field and making a recommendation that is in no way, you know, defensible or appropriate. Sometimes there's a blurred line there just due to the ambiguities of differences of opinion between different astrologers, which is, I imagine, an issue as well.
It's completely an issue. And, you know, that boils down to, well, what do you know about astrology? You know, for example, I can go on and on about all the things I think I know about astrology. But if I meet someone who's, you know, got 30, 40, 50 more years experience than I do, they might be able to see things with a little more depth that I don't. The issue is, can, you know, when this happens, can two astrologers have a conversation and say, well, why is it that we see things differently? And can they come together and say, all right, well, based on this logic, based on this understanding, which one does seem more appropriate? So that's when it comes down to, you know, how friendly and supportive can astrologers be towards each other?
Sure. Yeah. And just general ideas of like, you know, within the field of astrology, the extent to which you can have things like standardization or standards and different things like that. Or there's a lot of like related topics I'm sure we could get into, but
yeah,
to bring things back around to our main topic. So one of the things that you mentioned when we were talking about this previously is there's different definitions, I think, of how the Sati-Sati period is defined or calculated. And I was wondering, you know, we've talked primarily about what I think is the more standard one, which is like the three signs, the one before the moon, the sign of the moon, and then the sign after. But are there other ways that you would define that or narrow it down?
Well, when I'm looking at the Sati-Sati period, when I first got involved in astrology, I would certainly use the 7.5 year length that most people kind of focus on. However, that was because I easily bought into sort of the fear-based aspect of it. The more I practiced, the more I started to see that the more important time period for the Sati-Sati period was when Saturn was specifically in the sign of the moon. So when people write to me, I typically only focus on the Sati-Sati period when I see Saturn in the sign of the moon.
Okay.
So that's my focus, which is a 2.5 year period.
Sure. So that's really the most intense period, is as soon as Saturn ingresses into the natal sign of the moon, and then it ends as soon as Saturn leaves the natal sign of the moon.
Right. That's when I spend most of the time focusing on the Sati-Sati period. When I first used the 7.5 year period, and I might use this occasionally if I see other personal planets getting involved in the sign before or after, but I typically say that when it's in the sign before the moon, that's when you start to become aware of the things that might get lost, or the things you have to take more responsibility for, or where you might have been deficient in certain areas of your life. During the time when Saturn is in the sign of the moon, that's when everything hits and you're having the loss, you're having to deal with it. All you have is the emotional grief possibly that you're processing. And then when Saturn gets out of the sign of the moon and into that third sign, that's when you're starting to build your life back again. So it's when you've been torn down and now you're saying, okay, now this has happened. how do I want to live differently? How do I want to apply these lessons from the Siddhi Sati period so that the next time it's not so rough?
Right. And that makes sense to me, because that's very similar to the way, you know, like the houses are set up with what I call the angular triads, where you have the cadent house, which is sometimes when a planet moves into the cadent house, it can be like the beginning or things ramping up in a sequence of events. And then you have the angular house itself, which is the high point. And then you have the succedent house, this that's kind of like carrying forward and bringing to completion what happened in the previous two signs.
Exactly. That's exactly the logic behind it.
Sure. And that would make sense here, since, you know, you have that Chandra-Lagna chart where the ascendant is like an alternate, or the moon is like an alternative ascendant and a starting point for a set of whole sign houses. So the sign before the moon would be like the 12th house, and the sign of the moon would be like the first house, and the sign after the moon would be like the second house in that context.
Exactly. Yes.
Got it. So, and from that perspective, then it's almost like, you know, the Sati Sati period would almost be like starting a new Saturn cycle, in the sense that once it's going through the 12th house, it's finishing up a whole transit of Saturn through the 12 houses measured out from the moon. And then it gets to the moon's sign and it starts a new cycle over again. And then it gets the sign after, and then it's fully sort of into whatever that new 30-year cycle is. So in some sense, it's almost a parallel in a way to like the Saturn return or something like that.
It's very similar to the Saturn return. And the last bit you mentioned, when it gets to the end, and when it's at the sign right after the moon, when you're putting the pieces back together of your life, that theme of the Saturn transit, you know, 28 to 30 years, after you get out of the Sati Sati period, the things that you have learned, the things that you've put into play to improve upon the situation, then in a sense defines the next 28 to 30 years. And I'm always going to be kind of tying it back to the idea that Saturn deals with improvement, because Saturn sees problems and with the goal of seeing the problems to grow from them or to improve them. So the Sati Sati, yes, it can knock you down, but the difficulty a lot of people have is once they get knocked down, they say, oh, I was knocked down. That's terrible. So that's it. I'm done. Nothing else. But when you get knocked down by Saturn, his goal is not to just kick you in the head and say, stay down. His goal is to say, okay, well, now get up. And what can you do differently so I can't do that to you again? How can you improve your life? How can you become stronger, more endurant, and so on, so that you, again, become a more mature, responsible human being, essentially?
Sure. That makes sense. And then going through that process over the next 30 years of having, you know, different periods of like checking back in to see how that's going and how that's developing as Saturn continues to move through the other houses.
Right. And for example, one really good transit is supposed to be when Saturn when Saturn goes through the sign that is 11th from your moon. And when Saturn goes to the sign that's 11th from your moon, oftentimes you're getting a lot of support in your life. You're getting a lot of things working well for you. And whatever's working well for you during that transit, Saturn 11th from the moon, those are typically the things that you're meant to focus on to kind of keep you going, to keep you engaged in the game so that you can make it through the Sati Sati period. Like, for example, in my chart, when I went through my second Sati Sati period, Saturn was in the 11th from the moon. And that was when many of my books got published. Many of my classes started to grow, these sorts of things. And so when I actually went through my Sati Sati, that thing which kept me going, which kept me feeling like I had a purpose and a direction, was continuing to focus on my astrological work, continuing to focus on the teaching capacity and so on. So it's not just necessarily the Sati Sati period. There's also other periods too, which are all about really the development of Saturn. That's the key to this whole thing, is how is Saturn developing in your life?
Sure. That makes sense. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I just, you know, of course published my first book, and I would be going through my 11th. Saturn would be going through my 11th over the course of the past year or two.
Yeah, exactly. So these are the kinds of things that, you know, you pay attention to. And then should you go into your Sati Sati period and should there be some difficulties? Well, now you know, focusing on your work, your writing and teaching and these sorts of things, that's what's going to be important to kind of help carry you through the whole situation.
Sure, that makes sense. All right. And let's see, I'm sure, I mean, there's other things I'm sure that are relevant in terms of what part of the person's life this transit may manifest in. I imagine one of the primary things is just what house the moon is placed in natally, perhaps, as well as maybe what houses or what house the moon rules in the chart. Would you say that those would be two things that could help you to narrow down what part of the life it might apply to?
Yes, those are the two most important things. As you were saying that, that's what popped into my head. Number one, what house is the moon in, which you described? Number two, what house does the moon rule over? So, you know, if the moon is in the fourth house, well, maybe there's going to be a focus on changes or a focus on taking more responsibility for your home or your vehicle or your mother, all things related to the fourth house. If the moon rules over, say, the fifth house, maybe some of the responsibility or the time and attention required is going to be related to a person's children, to their creative capacity, improving how they use their mind to improve their life and so on. So it always boils down to those two things, the house the moon is in and the house that the moon rules, to give you more insights into how that Sati Sati is going to play out. And one more thing is that we always have to be aware of that sometimes those difficulties don't have to be bad. Like if the 10th house is involved, dealing with status and fame and career and activity, again, the earlier example, maybe it's just that you're going to be working damn hard for that 2.5 years to improve your status, to improve your fame, to work on your business. And that can ruin your marriage. You know, that can ruin your health. But if you know sort of the, if you know that in the end it might support these more positive things, hopefully you can manage the fallout, I suppose, a little bit better.
Sure, that makes sense. And here is also, it seems like, where some of the yogas could come into play, since the moon could rule one house and being placed in another could be creating a specific type of yoga. And then if you get Saturn transiting over that, that's when the yoga is going to come into play potentially, especially if the moon is also activated as a dasha or a time lord.
Exactly. And that's one of the ways that, you know, we typically use transits as we call them trigger transits, in that when we have something in the chart and a planet with a similar energy or quality crosses that point or aspects that point, then that's what triggers it to occur. Like one woman I was working with, she had all these planets, in one sign. And it was when she was going through a Saturn return, she was going through a Sati Sati, that these health issues and career issues got activated for her due to that particular transit impacting those planets related to those areas of her life.
Okay, got it. And what was the placement again?
So she had numerous planets in the 10th house.
Okay.
And they were all personal planets. And so when Saturn hit the sun, hit the ascendant lord, hit the moon all together in this 10th house, it was as if the life just kind of crumbled and she didn't know what to do with her health. She didn't know what to do with her career. She didn't know what to do with her parents. And so she's been spending the years after that sort of recuperating, trying to figure out, well, now how do I address this? How do I build my life back up? So that's how those transits can trigger certain karmas within the chart, or yogas, as you use the term.
Okay, that makes sense. And mm-hmm. One other thing that might be worth exploring or talking about, or a question that I had, is, are there any standard mitigations, or are there any types of mitigations that might make this transit of Saturn over the natal moon easier for certain people or more difficult for other people? Like I know, you know, there's other offsetting things in traditional Western astrology that can mitigate placements for better or worse. Are there any standard ones when it comes to this that are commonly mentioned?
Sure. There's a few things. So following a couple threads you have there, number one is that we do have to remember that Saturn and the moon, they act differently for different ascendants. So for example, Saturn itself can be more difficult for a Cancer ascendant because it rules the 7th and the 8th houses, which especially the 8th house can be a more difficult house. Whereas say for a Libra ascendant, Saturn rules over the fourth and the fifth house. So it rolls over a trine and an angle, which makes it typically more graceful, more beneficial for a Libra ascendant. And so that means that generally, Sadie Sati, Saturn Returns, Saturn Transits, they will innately act differently depending on what your ascendant sign is. Now, to follow that up, when it comes to remedies for the Sadie Sati period, there's a few things. Number one, always being of service, volunteering, helping to feed homeless people, helping to help people that are less fortunate than you. This is one of the prime ways to work through a Sadie Sati period. Number one, we have to remember that Saturn is the producer of misfortune and poverty to a degree. And so if you are helping people who suffer from that, you are in a sense appeasing that aspect of your consciousness. So that's more of an esoteric stance on it. Number two, what most people find is that when they're going through a Sadie Sati period and they do things like serve the homeless or help people who are less fortunate, they end up actually seeing that, hey, their life isn't that bad. So it gives them perspective in regards to what they're going through. Doing mantras for Saturn can be extremely helpful, but really the key is, on a more behavioral, psychological level, is paying attention to where the suffering is occurring and then asking oneself, what can I do to be more responsible in this life to manage this situation? Because most of the time when people have difficulty with Sadie Sati or Saturn return, it's because there's an aspect of their life that they're not being mature about or they're not being responsible about. Like someone who goes through a Sadie Sati or Saturn return dealing with the 10th house again, you know, maybe their career takes a hit, but maybe they learn all the things that they've been doing wrong in their career. And so they have to learn to admit those things and then improve upon them. So the best way to work with Sadie Sati is truly self-awareness and then doing one's best to improve on how they relate to those difficulties within their life. Does this make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, sometimes I'm thinking back to that story and the myth of the greatness of Saturn that you're talking about earlier, and some of those themes of, I mean, one of the themes towards the end is it almost seemed like the main character eventually sort of, I don't know if this is the right word, but like submitted to yes. it or allowed himself to, yeah, to sort,
exactly.
to sort of submit to just that he was going through a period of suffering and that he needed to let go in some sense and just fully take in or experience what that was like, because there was something integral to just going through a process of, you know, suffering or loss that itself allowed him eventually to achieve almost like a sense of enlightenment through understanding what that aspect of existence or life was about.
Exactly. And that's a very key point, is that towards the end of that story, King Vikramaditya, he essentially surrenders. And by surrendering, he's able to make peace with the pain and difficulty that he's gone through. And I think that this is really a more profound blessing of the Sadie Sati or even the Saturn return time period, because again, it comes down to this fact that even if we can manage life perfectly, even if we are a king, even if everything's going beautifully, suffering still exists in the world. And I've had people ask me, when I've taught in meditation classes and Kriya Yoga classes, they say, is there anything that can, is there anything that can help us through grief or through this pain or through this suffering? And as someone who's gone through a fairly difficult Sadie Sati period, I have to admit that it wasn't until I finally said, look, there's nothing I can do about this. I just have to cry. I just have to grieve. I just have to feel this pain, that things became lighter, that things became, in a sense, put more into perspective. So the whole issue is really, if we get down to it, is learning that there is suffering in life and we have to do our best with it. And we cannot control every situation. That's why Saturn is considered to be the ego destroyer. Not to just be maliciously stepping on your head and trying to squeeze your brains out through your ears, but he's trying to show you that you are a very small part in a very bigger picture or a very, very big story. And you're not going to know the reasons or the whys that certain things occur. But if you can learn to surrender while doing your best, then life becomes more peaceful and you become more capable, with what life brings to you, I suppose. So, you know, I always look at Saturn as the clearest, teacher. You know, some people say in Vedic astrology, Jupiter is the great teacher. But really, if you can make peace and understand and appreciate and accept and welcome Saturn into your life, there's nothing else you can't do. You know, you've pretty much got it there.
So. Right. Yeah, I like that. That seems to be one of the main underlying themes here that keeps coming up in this discussion, which is this, in going through those heavy Saturn transits, a difference sometimes between when to control and when to learn to take better charge of your life in order to do that which you should be doing better, to right. truly do it better, if it's within your control, versus those things, acknowledging and recognizing those things that are outside of your control, that can't necessarily be reversed or get better, and just learning to let go and to be okay with that if that's what's necessary.
Exactly. And, you know, it always comes down to, what do they call it? The serenity prayer. You know, it's something like, God, give me the capacity to change those things that I can change, to endure those things which I can't change, and to have the wisdom to know the difference. That's the lesson of the Sedi Sati Saturn return, most Saturn issues in a nutshell, I think.
That's perfect. I mean, I think that's a perfect encapsulation of what I was just talking about and the sort of thread that's been running through most of this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to take that a step further, did you have more you wanted to explain upon that before I launch into something else?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So to take it a step further, one thing I love to encourage people to understand is that in our astrological chart, we have cruel planets, we have gentle planets, we have malefic planets, benefic planets, we have nice planets, we have mean planets for a reason. They are all a part of our makeup. And the issue is not to say Saturn is bad, let's get rid of him. The issue is to say, well, what is Saturn's role and how can we love that and embrace that and appreciate that in the same way that we would do that with Mercury, or we would do that with Venus and so on. So what I see as the real focus of astrology and even understanding Saturn is coming to terms with all these facets of our consciousness that the planets represent and trying our best to endure suffering when it's there, Saturn, to logically take care of problems when they arise, Mars, to appreciate the luxury and love in life, Venus, to be inspired and to be able to follow our Dharma and our path, the Sun, and so on. So if we're able to see what each planet represents for us as a facet of our consciousness, and if we can do our best to appreciate and love that, then we become a fully integrated human being. And that's why Sedi Sati, Saturn return, any Saturn issue is extremely important to pay attention to, because that's usually the thing that we want to sweep under the rug and completely ignore, which effectively arrests all of our development. And so it doesn't matter if we know about our Sun or we know about our Venus, because we've skipped this fundamental primary issue of human existence, which Saturn represents.
Sure, that makes sense. And that makes me think of something I meant to mention earlier, which I always think is interesting when talking to Indian astrologers about the concept of karma, which is that in Indian astrology, like, the entire chart is treated as if it's the result of past karmas, and every part of the chart has to do with karma on some level. Whereas in some of the, like, modern Western, especially New Age astrology, there's a tendency to attempt to attribute karma only to certain things, like to say that, like, Saturn is the planet of karma, or that the nodes are the only thing in the chart that has to do with past lives or something like that.
Right.
And it's interesting how different that is actually in Indian astrology, where that's not really the case.
Well, it's not the case in the way I interpret it. I mean, I understand the focus on the nodes and the focus on Saturn, because Saturn are the things that we have not been responsible for that we have to take care of, so it causes us problems. Rahu, or the North Node, is that thing which we want to develop, which we haven't, and so it's going to cause us problems because we're not skilled in it yet, but we can become skilled. Ketu is the planet that shows us where we've put a lot of time and attention, and we've become sort of hyper-fixated on, so we try to use it as a safety net to define ourselves. So they are the most obvious planets when it comes to this idea of what most people think about karma. And when we think about the other planets, though, they are certainly our karma. I mean, if you think about it, the fact that I have a black phone, that's a karma. That's a tendency that I have. The fact that I enjoy pizza with green peppers on it, that's a karma. So from the Vedic astrological perspective, it's more like anything that's in your awareness, that's in your consciousness, is a result of some past intention, thought, or tendency, which is why everyone can be so radically different in that regard. I mean, think about people who are always in wonderful relationships, and then you meet someone else who never is in a wonderful relationship. Or think about someone who, always has problems with their health, and you meet someone else who kind of has problems with their health, and someone who has no problems with their health. All these things are represented by the planets, which represent the general trajectory of our past actions, of our past karma. So everything, in a sense, becomes karma in that regard. That's the way I look at it, at least.
Right. I mean, that's just really interesting to me, just because, there has been this attempt to almost cherry pick some concepts, in Western astrology, like karma and reincarnation, and to apply them to certain things on a very surface level. But
right.
In looking at longer traditions where those concepts have been used for thousands of years, or where they originated, you have a much more detailed or sort of nuanced understanding of that and of what karma is when you're using that as a concept, as applying to everything, even if, maybe in order to step back from that a bit and be a little bit more, not gracious, but, maybe part of the reason for that is just that with Saturn, it's something that's much more evident in terms of if you wanted to use that notion of karma, maybe there's something more evident about, in some instances, what you're not doing, or in terms of like retribution in some instances, if there's something right. that you've done wrong, that you can get, a real sense of getting pushback from the universe from that. And maybe that's one of the reasons why there's been a tendency to push karma in some Western traditions more onto planets like Saturn.
Well, I think it really depends on what you're interested in. For example, in the New Age spiritual astrological community, I mean, there's a strong sort of scorpionic Pluto-like focus. And I make a joke with one of my other astrologer friends, Channing Ayers. Whenever we do, we sometimes do these kind of monthly reports on, what to expect. Not too often, because I try not to get into that too much, because I think it's more important what's going on in your own chart. Mm-hmm. But we make a joke. I tell her, I say, look, you get your jar out, I'll get my jar out. Anytime someone says the word transformation, challenges to the ego, evolution, the whole host of words that seem to be everywhere in astrological speech. Anytime we use that word, I got to put a dollar in my jar, or you got to put a dollar in your jar. because most astrologers are hyper fixated on this idea of transformation and avoiding suffering and so on. Whereas really the whole human experience is related to the astrological chart. So that's why, again, if you're more fixated or focused on sort of the pain or retribution mindset that Saturn can engender, you're going to have that kind of, approach to things. But if you kind of see everything as an expression of consciousness or divine consciousness or whatever it might be, it tends to mellow everything out. And if you're not cool with things being mellow, you're going to focus more on the difficult things like Saturn and Rahu and Mars and so on.
Sure. Right. As well as just there's a tendency, it's a tendency in all astrological traditions, but it's more easily seen sometimes in some of the modern traditions where there's a tendency to almost like what I've called in the past, like to fetishize like Pluto, or to fetishize right. like the nodes or something like that. I mean, I'm sure that happens in other traditions where you
Certainly.
Have a tendency sometimes where astrologers will gravitate towards, focusing on and really making like a single concept, like the center point of the entirety of astrology. Right. And I don't know, are there any things like that? I don't know if this counts, but would this be one of those things like Sati Sati, where maybe some astrologers could overblow it and say that this is like the most important thing ever? Or are there other things in Indian astrology that sort of meet that bar?
Well, the focus almost always when it comes to why, if I think about why are people typically wanting to get sessions with me, I can almost always tell you it's going to be due to Saturn, or it's going to be due to Rahu and Ketu, or it's going to be due to Mars. So if you think about it, it's almost always related to what we call the cruel or the malefic planets. Because really, I mean, is someone going to come to an astrologer if everything is going great and there's no problems whatsoever?
I mean, are they naturally gravitating towards wanting to explore those things because those are areas where they have problems in their lives? Or are they wanting to come to you because they've heard bad things and they're like worried because there's some like general, almost like pop astrology concern around those things?
I see. I don't get too many people writing to me saying, Well, I mean, occasionally I do. Someone will say, oh, they talked about Mercedes Satie and they painted it completely horrible. And that happens a lot. But most, what I'm trying to say is that most of the time when I'm researching a chart, the things that they want to know about typically always revolve around Saturn or Mars or Rahu or Ketu and so on. Okay. I do have a few videos on my YouTube channel specific to the Sadi Sati period. And even at astralvedicastrology.com under the downloadable courses page, there's a free class that I did on how to deal with the Sadi Sati period. And so when people come to me with that kind of preconceived notion about, I've heard that this is horrible, I usually just refer them to that to get a sense of what it's all about. But I got to say that in my practice, not too often do I have people coming to me specifically because they've heard something horrible like that.
Sure. I think there's one other one that I heard that I mentioned to you before, which is Kuja Dosha, or the idea of like Mars affliction. I mean, is that one that you think
Yes.
that people like overblow in Indian astrology, or that, you know, is like commonly worried about?
Well, I think it's an important thing to consider, but we also have to remember the issue of what Kuja Dosha is. So essentially, Kuja Dosha deals with Mars, and it deals with if Mars is placed in the 2nd, 4th, 7th, 8th, or 12th houses. And the reason this is important is because if Mars is in the 2nd house, well, the 2nd house is often related to family and happiness, so it can show a person has a lot of misunderstandings with their family. If it's in the 4th house, that's our sense of emotional buoyancy and contentment. And if Mars is there, we'll tend to have more aggression internally. We'll be more easily disturbed by a violent nature, possibly. 7th house deals with the spouse. So putting Mars in the house of spouse can make a person suffer from aggression in the spousal relationship. It can even be domestic violence. 8th house, vitality and so on. 12th house can deal with difficulties with like expenses or even infidelity and so on. So that is something to pay attention to. But most of the time when people write to me about Kuja Dosha, or Mangalik is what it's called, it's usually a woman. And she's usually saying, an astrologer has said, I've got this, and therefore I will never be happy in relationships. And the reason they're saying that is because when Mars gets in these positions, it tends to make a woman more aggressive isn't really the word. They usually stand up for themselves more. They're more type A personality. And in traditional Indian culture, that's not really, from my understanding, that's not really a thing to be. They want the spouse to be, you know, meek and just only serving the husband. They don't want a spouse that's going to talk back or stand up for themselves. So there are issues with that Kuja Dosha, but most of the time when people write to me, it's because they've been told that they're not going to get married or have a good relationship. But what I tell them is they just have to be able to find a partner that will appreciate a strong woman. And if they can do that, then things can be okay. You know, that's just a general way of looking at it.
Sure. Yeah, it seems like it's like the generic statement that's usually put out there is that people understand it as indicating something bad or terrible for relationships or for the person's love life, I think is usually the sort of generic statement associated with Kuja Dosha, right?
Right. And that's the general statement, but the underlying theme that no one's going to tell you about is that what the astrologer typically means is, you know, you are a strong willed woman and men don't like that.
Right. Yeah. No, I love that. And so when you actually break that down and why some of those placements might actually be relevant for that, you realize that it's not such a bad thing, but it's just that it's often misconstrued as something else, or that it has to be something terrible when in fact there may be ways in which that can be perfectly fine. And it doesn't mean that you're going to be unhappy in relationships, or that you're never going to be married, or that you're going to lose a partner or something like that.
Right. And you know, one final thing I would say about that is that it is very specific on how the planet is qualified. You know, for example, is Mars a good planet for your ascendant? Number two, is Mars in good dignity? Is it naturally going to bring in some positive things to your chart? Number three, does it have support from its friends? So I do want to be very cautious when I make these statements that I don't just use that as a blanket statement, that I really have to qualify it by numerous angles before I would say one way or the other. But that's just the general theme behind it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's really so important, because it seems like a continuous theme throughout most older forms of astrology is that there's some, you know, specific interpretive principles sometimes that, you know, some specific general placement will indicate good things, or some general placement will indicate bad things. And that's like the surface level understanding, but then there's a deeper understanding that there's mitigations and there's different shades of gray underneath that, or there's things that can sometimes completely contradict it and make it go one way or the other. But oftentimes the public like doesn't get to that deeper understanding, but instead you just hear the very surface level thing, and that's as far as, you know, some people go, and then they get freaked out about it for that reason, for obvious reasons.
Exactly. They do a little bit of research. You know, it's why Google can sometimes be dangerous. They do a little bit of research. They say, oh, look, Saturn's in the second house, which is Munglik, which causes these difficulties with family and happiness. And they latch onto that, but they don't say, oh, well, maybe you're a Sagittarius ascendant and Mars is exalted in your second house and it's, you know, aspected by Jupiter. It's, you know, so you need to follow a little bit further. But not only is it that way with clients and regular people who want to understand astrology for their own sake, but it's also rampant in people who are learning astrology, and which is one of the reasons why the focus on this 4-year apprenticeship program, because people will read a book and they won't have any of the background information about how to determine what does that mean, Mars being exalted in the second house. And so then they jump to more conclusions. So the overall issue with astrology is that, as you know, it takes a lot of study. You got to look at it from a lot of different angles, and you can't make an assessment simply because you know one, probably 32nd of the entire formula behind it. You know, and same thing with Sadie Satie and on all Saturn issues as well. It's always got to come down to this sort of deeper analysis in regards to how is it actually functioning in the individual's chart, which is why I personally try to avoid like, doing generalized transit reports and so on, because those transits are going to impact you maybe 200% differently than they're going to impact me. And it's because your chart is different than mine. We always have to remember that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's a really good point. There's actually a few good points there, but one of them that's interesting is just, what was the part you said just before that last part about the general transits?
That you have to consider each individual person's chart before you understand the transits. Was that it?
Yeah. Sorry. I just like lost my thought.
It's okay.
I'm trying to recover it. So
I almost lost it too.
Right. No, I think it was something you said actually right before that, but I was just thinking about, but that was before that. I was thinking about the concept of, it's not accidental, beneficence. It's accidental. I'm trying to think of the term, because you've referred to a few times this concept, and I just wanted to make sure we outlined it, of planets, when a planet is a functional benefic versus a functional malefic based on what houses it rules. That's a very unique concept in Indian astrology that has some crossover in traditional ancient astrology, but it's never very well articulated. And so I was wondering if you could expand on that just for a second, just because it's actually very important as one of the mitigating factors, it seems like, that you're talking about for some of these placements, including Sati Sati.
Sure. Yeah. So if we consider Mars, for example, since we were talking about Kuja Dosha here, let's think of a Cancer ascendant. So if we have a Cancer ascendant, then what we're going to have is Mars will be ruling over, the fifth and the 10th house? Do I have that right? I got to think about it.
If you have what ascendant? Aries?
Cancer ascendant.
Oh, so Cancer ascendant. So yes, Scorpio would be the fifth house and Aries would be the 10th house.
Exactly. So for a Cancer ascendant, Mars then rules over the fifth house, a trinal house, a house of purpose and dharma and inspiration. And it rules over the 10th house, which is a house of action and activity and power within the world. So in that regard, Mars works very well for a Cancer ascendant. But then if you look at a Virgo ascendant, we're going to see that Mars rules over the third house and the eighth house. And these are two extremely difficult houses. The third house deals with sometimes violence and egotism and so on. And the eighth house can deal with sudden breaks and changes. And so in that regard, the planet Mars will tend to work better in regards to supporting their purpose and path in life for the Cancer ascendant versus how it functions for a Virgo ascendant, because the houses they rule are difficult or are good. Does that explain it?
Yeah, I think that's perfect. So to consolidate the statement or the underlying principle, it's that There are certain houses of the 12 houses in the chart. There are certain houses that indicate, generally speaking, positive things or are auspicious. And there's certain yes. houses that tend to indicate more difficult or inauspicious or negative things. And that when a planet rules a positive house or positive houses in the chart, then it becomes functionally more of a positive or a benefic planet in the chart, even if the planet itself is normally a malefic, like Mars or Saturn.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yes.
So versus if a planet rules negative houses in the chart, then it's going to take on some of those more negative qualities and become functionally more of a malefic or a difficult planet, even if it's normally, in terms of its inherent properties, a benefic planet like Venus or Jupiter.
Exactly. And that takes it a little bit further into the idea of how people function in the world. You know, for example, if we think about spirituality, you know, we see all these kinds of spirituality where people are striving for these lofty goals and they're trying to be the best person possible and they're all inspired and devotional. Well, that'll work very well for a Jupiter ruled ascendant or a Cancer ascendant and so on. But if we're looking at, say, Libra or Virgo or Gemini, where planets like Mercury and Saturn are better planets, well, that would show a spiritual approach to life, which is actually more grounded in simply being present in reality, dealing with problems as they arise. And that if a person tries to get on board with those spiritualities that are more lofty and inspirational and charismatic and so on, they'll actually tend to fail spiritually speaking. So again, the whole point is that the deeper you go into this, you actually start to see the specifics of how every ascendant functions optimally within the world based on how the planets are situated from that ascendant. So it's pretty fascinating, I think.
Yeah, that's really hugely important. And that gets tied into the concept of yogas as well. And then this, of course, becomes very important as a potential mitigating factor in interpreting Sati Sati in terms of what houses Saturn rules. And if it's natural, its tendency to be a natural malefic is right. either emphasized or is mitigated positively based on what houses it rules in the natal chart.
Exactly. So knowing that information, you would approach how you discuss Sati Sati with a client differently. So that's the key there. You nailed it.
Sure. And just to circle back, because I actually remembered the point that I forgot like 5 minutes ago, but when you were talking about, you know, there's this real distinction that was coming back up of, you know, book learning or abstract learning of a concept like, you know, like you were saying, Mangala or like Kucha Dosha, where you have Mars in certain positions and then what that is said to sometimes indicate versus right. the importance of sitting down and what you learn, the wisdom that is gained through experience and through talking with clients about their lives and charts. And then I right. loved that example you gave where it sounded like from experience, what you've observed is like, yeah, you've sat down and you've talked to some women who have that placement, but what happened was that they just tended to be more strong-willed. And that didn't necessarily always work out well within the context of like a traditional relationship, because sometimes, you know, it did create tensions and then perhaps the relationship didn't work out. But that doesn't mean exactly. that the person is doomed, you know, not to have any relationships. They just need to take that into account, or there needs to be some allowance for that for certain types of relationships that they might be more well suited to. And that's just something that clearly, you know, comes out of the wisdom of you, you know, having those experiences with clients that you can only get from that versus just reading the principle in a book.
Right. Exactly. And if you think about it with Kuja Dosha, you know, what's actually one of the remedies for it to overcome it? Well, it's actually to marry someone who has it themselves.
Oh, right, right. That's the traditional like recommendation is if you have that, then you get in a relationship with somebody else that has it, and it almost like cancels the other out or something.
Well, it's said to cancel it out, but what I found is it's just that you understand each other better. Like, you know, if you have that kind of aggressiveness and that type A drive, and you get together with someone who also has it, you can respect each other and you understand where you're coming from, which makes it work out better. So that's one of the interesting things that you can kind of delve into when you look at these remedies is, well, what's the logic behind it? And that helps you understand what the actual issue is in the first place.
Right. That's funny. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm trying to think if there's anything else with respect to our main topic that we haven't covered. We covered a lot of ground in this episode, and I'm really happy with how this discussion went. And I think people are going to get a lot from it, especially my you know, the part of my audience that tends to be more Western astrologers that don't have a lot of experience with these concepts. I think there's a lot of great crossover potential in ways that people will become, you know, more interested in learning Indian astrology as a result of this. Is there anything we should mention with respect to Sati Sati that we haven't gotten to at this point?
You know, I think we've covered pretty much all of the foundational material. If people want to learn more, I mean, I've got plenty of videos on my YouTube channel dealing with it, but really it will just be a reiteration of what we've already discussed. So it's, I think we've done pretty good.
Sure. Yeah. But you have some, I mean, that's a great thing we should mention just because I've been following your YouTube channel for a while and you've got just a great, you've got hundreds of videos. What are you up to at this point? Do you know how many?
It's well over 250, so I can't say. Okay. I just keep doing it.
So you've got just a ton of great videos on different aspects of Indian astrology, both in the techniques and the philosophy, as well as a lot of great interviews. And what's the URL? Your YouTube channel is youtube.com/Ryan's Vedic Astrology, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And then you've also got a couple of books, which you sent me, which are actually really amazing. And are these sort of standalone, or are these supposed to be tied in more to your courses?
Well, I wrote them as standalone material. So the first book was actually Richard Fish, who is my main teacher. It was way back in the day when you had to take correspondence courses via actual stamp and postage. So this was a correspondence course that he had created that we just decided to turn into a book, which is a foundational ideas of Vedic astrology. And then the second book, The Art and Science of Vedic Astrology, Volume 2, those are essentially collections of notes from all the classes I've taught, which I turned into a book. So it's standalone, but it forms the foundation as a textbook for many of the classes that I do have available.
Okay. And in terms of the classes you have available, what is your website again?
It's AshevilleVedicAstrology.com.
Okay. And you teach through that site. That's your main sort of apprenticeship or foundational courses are available there?
Yeah. I have a section for downloadable courses, which are, I mean, there's probably, 10 or 12 courses that I've done over the past 3 or 4 years that are audio courses and video courses that you can download. And I haven't been doing too many of those anymore because I have focused more on this astrology apprenticeship program, which there's also a link to that, which is there's 3 classes per year and 4 years. And it's also done online as well. So that's the direction that I've been going with that website.
Okay, awesome. Well, yeah, I think people should definitely check that out. And just by, you know, going through your YouTube channel, I think that's a great, you know, in addition to this podcast, checking out your YouTube channel is a great way to get a sense of your teaching style, which tends to be very, you know, straightforward and approachable and sensible, it seems like. So I would recommend people check out your YouTube channel and then check out your website for more information about your work and your courses. And you're also a consulting astrologer, of course, right?
I am. I mainly do Prajna astrology now, which I think you all call, what do you call that? Horary? Is that what that
is? Yeah, horary astrology.
Yeah, so I mainly do horary astrology and also Muhurta, which is that electional astrology?
Yeah, electional.
Yeah, so those are the 2 things I mainly focus on at this point, but I do have a waiting list if people are interested.
Okay, brilliant. Well, people should then check out your website, which is AshevilleVedicAstrology.com, and I'll put a link to that and the YouTube channel in the description page for this episode of the podcast. But yeah, thanks a lot for joining me today.
No problem. I really appreciate it. We covered a lot of good ground, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad we've got a chance to do this because I've been meaning to talk about it for quite a while. And I thought, you know, after seeing some of your videos that it would be a great opportunity. So yeah, thanks again.
No problem.
All right. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.